thought it might be well for us this morning to really focus on a passage out of the Gospel of John. When you look at the Gospels, we see that each one is a little bit unique because of the audience and purpose of the writing. Matthew, in writing to primarily a Jewish audience, uses a lot of the Old Testament, fulfillment of prophecies, and explaining who Jesus is, what Jesus did. Mark, in his writing, was writing to Romans. And Romans were kind of like the bottom line people, and that is, don't give us a lot of details, just give us the bottom line. Give us the power of Christ. And so when we look at Mark, we see that he does not waste very many words at all. Luke, in his writing, is writing to the Greeks. And therefore, he's writing more of an intellectual type of letter. More of the parables of Christ. The teaching of Christ is emphasized a lot in Luke. John, though, does us a big favor in that he's writing a little bit later and answering a lot of the arguments made by a group of people called the agnostics. And the agnostics really question the whole idea of deity, whether God exists, but also of the fact that who Jesus himself was. And so John, in his writing, tells us a lot about Jesus and the Father. And this passage here in, let me see here, get it working, in John 5th chapter deals with that. We want to look again at this passage. When we start off, we find a number of details and interesting information given to us in this 5th chapter, verse 1 through 9. First of all, it said that after this was the Feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. I don't think I have to tell everybody here this morning where Jerusalem was and the significance of that city. It was, after all, the city of David. It was the place where the temple was. It was the place where the Sadducees and the Pharisees had their focus. Was at that place in particular. I said, now there was in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. Again, interesting because Jerusalem's on a mountain, on a big hill. But Jerusalem was not lacking for water. They had a number of different pools throughout the city that people could go and bathe in and get water from. And so it was well supplied. And so he has to identify for us where this pool was in particular. But then it becomes a little bit more unique. And then it says, and these lay a green boat to the sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. If you just kind of get this visual in your mind, of here you have this pool of people, and you have all these people that are sick, something's wrong with them. And they're just standing around this pool, laying there, sitting there. And it explains to us the next verse why they were there. It says, for an angel went down at a certain time to the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever stepped in first after stirring the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Some translations has this kind of a parenthetical statement. Some maybe even adds another phrase or two, and then it's saying that was the tradition that had been established. In other words, this was maybe more along the lines of simply a fable or something that had been taught. But whatever it was, and that is they stayed there and they were looking for something to happen with the water, and then they would, okay, the first one gets in, gets well. Well, that presents a little problem, doesn't it? And that is, that means only one person then that's sitting there or lying there is actually being made well whenever and if that ever happened. And if even that was true. And so the man points out, said, now there's a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. That's a long time, isn't it? That means his lifetime. In fact, a lot of times when we look at the 5th chapter of John, the emphasis is on the latter part of this chapter because there we have this man talking and his parents and the crowd's reaction because he's well known and he had been this way for all his life. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" And goes on, the sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." And so this was kind of like the impossible situation as far as how would he beat anybody else into the water? Even if this was true, how am I going to be made well? So Jesus said to him, "Rise up, take your bed and walk." And immediately the man's made well, took up his bed and walked, and that day was a Sabbath. So we have the healing done. If you go on and read the next few verses of this chapter, you find that this created a reaction because this man, again, he's walking around, and it's a Sabbath day, he has his bed, and you would think, now there should be a lot of reaction to this. One is the reaction of astonishment and amazement. But this man suddenly could walk. I think most of us would see that as the primary emphasis of this passage. After all, and I know Steve's not here this morning, but what will we think if next Sunday morning Steve comes in walking and is just fine and has no problems at all? We would be amazed by that, wouldn't we? I don't know how many of us would start and look around for a reason to criticize that kind of situation, but that's what these people here did. And that they had a question of this man, and that is, how come you're carrying your bed on the Sabbath day? Which seems to be one of those questions like, what? I mean, where are you coming from, that question? And so as you go on verse 89, Jesus said, take up your bed and walk. Immediately the man's made well, took his bed and walked that day on the Sabbath. Now again, that presented the problem. And that seemed to be one of the more constant criticisms of Jesus, the fact that he did things on the Sabbath day. And so you go on and you find that then they asked him, that is, who is the man who said to you, take your bed and walk? Now the man told him that he had been healed, and they said, well, who? Who told you to get up, take your bed and walk? Again, their tradition was that we know from the Old Testament that Sabbath day was to be holy. There was to be no work on that Sabbath day. Their tradition they had developed was that almost doing anything on a Sabbath day was wrong. And so that's where they're coming from. Who told you to take a bed and walk? And it goes ahead, and verse 16, it goes, skip down a little bit, it said, for this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Now you look at that passage, and what you find there, what's interesting is that he had done these things, referring to a number of actual things he had done that really upset them. Sabbath day was like one of those things that's almost like a convenient excuse. Have you ever found somebody that they're wanting a reason to be mad at you? They want a reason to reject you, and all they're doing and all they need is some excuse, and it may be some obscure thing that really doesn't matter in the big scheme of things, but they find it and they really use that. Well, the Sabbath day to them was kind of like that. And so we look here, we find Jesus' response to that. And I want us to focus on that. Because again, this tells us a lot about who Jesus is and our relationship to him. And when Jesus replied to them, as go down verse 17, Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Therefore, the Jews sought him more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." Now, one of the things that really upset them is the fact, okay, the Sabbath day, is going back to the Old Testament, we find that when God created the heavens and the earth, and we read about all the creation in the first chapter of Genesis, and then God on the sixth day saw everything that he had done, and so in Genesis 2, verse 2, it says, "And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he'd done, and he rests on the seventh day from all his work which he had done." Now, of course, you skip on over to Exodus, and Exodus, the 20th chapter, and verse 10, 9, 10, 11, it tells there about keeping the Sabbath day holy. And as the Jews, they were to treat it as a special day. In verse 11, it says in particular, because God created everything 6 days, on the seventh day he rested. Now again, when we look at that, we understand, okay, God wanted this day to be special, but be a special day. And so the Jews had treated it as a special day to the point that they redefined what work was, what people could do, and they said you couldn't do anything on Sabbath day. Now let me make this point here before we get any farther along. is that sometimes today people talk about the Sabbath day, and they're not talking about the Sabbath day. Sometimes today people are talking about the Sabbath day, and they are really meaning Sunday. My grandpa was one of those that he believed you should not work on the Sabbath day, but he worked every Saturday that he could. But he thought that was Sunday, was referring to Sabbath day. It was not. It's the seventh day of the week, which is Saturday. But also, my grandpa had an interesting viewpoint of this, and that is, he said you shouldn't work on Sunday, but he did not have a problem at all with grandma making lunch or dinner on Saturday, on Sunday. She can go in that kitchen and she could work all she wanted. He wasn't upset about that one bit. And so in his mind, he couldn't work on Sunday, but for some reason, that really wasn't work. Well, again, we understand there are certain things that were allowed on the Sabbath day. The priest went ahead and made the sacrifices on the Sabbath day. That child was circumcised the eighth day, and that would be sometimes on the Sabbath day. They would perform that ceremony. So the idea there wasn't anything you could do on the Sabbath day was simply a misconstruction of what the whole idea was. But Jesus just points out to him, he said, God rests on the Sabbath day. And what we find is that, well, God, that didn't mean God didn't do anything at all. When you think about the creation God made and the fact that we have the sun orbiting the earth orbiting the sun, going to reconstruct our universe on it. But anyway, if we have the earth orbiting the sun and we have rain and we have good things happening as far as the vegetation grows on Sunday, then on Sabbath day, then you understand that means the universe is still sustained by God. And so we look at this here, the passage and the Bible just points out that these things happen. And Hebrews 1 verse 3 says, talking about Christ being the brightness of glory and the express image of his person and this part of holding all things by the word of his power. And that is, how does the universe continue to exist today? How does everything work today? Well, God created it, and God's power still sustains it. So even on the Sabbath day, they still had the sun rising, and they still had rain on that day. And Acts 14, verse 17 said, nevertheless, talking about God, he did not leave himself without witness, and that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful season, filled our hearts with food and gladness. I don't know if Kevin goes out every day and measures his corn once it gets started growing. But I dare say it probably grows some on the Sabbath day, doesn't it? If it existed back then, if you were back then, you would see that corn growing on Sabbath day as well as on any other day of the week. And so we look here and realize, well, you know, God sustains the universe on Sabbath day. That's good. And not only that, but also sends sunshine and rain on Sabbath day. And Matthew 5, verse 45 said that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for it makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. We could just put in there, and even on the Sabbath day, that still happens. And so we still have sunshine and rain on Sabbath day. That means nothing happens at all. And Jesus, in fact, points out that it's good to do good on the Sabbath day. In Luke, the sixth chapter, they bring a man with a withered hand to Jesus. And they want him to see what he's going to do about this. Now, this wasn't the first time this happened. But Jesus, in Luke 6, chapter verse 9, said to them, in fact, he asked the question, is it okay to do good or do evil on Sabbath day? Well, verse 9 says, I ask you one thing, is lawful on Sabbath to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy? And when he looked around at them all, he said to them, stretch out your hand. And he did so, his hand was restored as whole as the other. And they were filled with rage and discuss one another what they might do to Jesus. You know, Jesus did not break the Sabbath day. I remember you look and there's times they accuse him of it. And my idea of that one time was, well, he's son of God. If he wanted to do something on Sabbath day, he could do it. That's okay. But no, he didn't break the Sabbath day. It's good to do good on Sabbath day. That's why he's pointing out this. And again, that upset them because they thought that was wrong. But then also another reply was, they said to them, my Father has been working till now, and I have been working. Well, that's another thing that really upset them a lot about Jesus, that he referred to God as my Father and not our Father. And that is, when we use that word my, we're talking about a unique relationship. We're talking about something that is special. And I know in one sense we can all refer to God as our God or my God. We could say he's the God of each one of us. But Jesus was using this, implying a special relationship he had with the Father. Now we know what that special relationship was, and that is he's talking about the fact of deity. But there's other people that talk about God and that special relationship, and other types of special relationship. For instance, David often used the phrase, my God. When you look over in Psalm 71, verse 4, it said, deliver me, O my God, out of the hand of the wicked, out of the hand of the unrighteous and cruel man. And just look through the Psalms, and it's amazing the number of times David used the word, my God, my salvation, my rock, my, and just used my Lord, and it's a special relationship he had with God. Well, Jesus uses in a very special relationship with God because, again, he's the Son of God. In fact, you go through the Gospels and you look for my Father. Now, not every time if you use a word processor program, a Bible program, and you just type that in and say Gospels, you're going to get about, I forget, about 89 times. Sometimes not Jesus referring to God that way. Sometimes it's simply enough people refer to their Father. But Jesus uses it a lot, such as Matthew 7:21. Not everyone says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. You know, notice here, not just God, but my Father. And then also in John 10:30, I and my Father are one. And so he points out here simply the special relationship he had with Jesus. And he saw himself as the Son, as one being involved in the same activities with his Father. It's part of the idea. When you talk about somebody being my Father or my God, for instance, that with our children. And sometimes somebody may look at one of our children and say, well, I know who your dad is. And usually they start crying at that point because they know what's going to come next. But what it means is that, you know, oftentimes people say, well, that you look like your dad. And the physical characteristics. Well, you know, sometimes in the Bible it's used that way in, as far as the spiritual characteristics. Jesus and his Father being one as far as spiritually the characteristics of each one. But also in the same activities. In other words, sometimes when you look at a child, you may ask the child, are you going to be a school teacher like your mom or dad? Or are you going to be a farmer like your dad? And when we're asking, are you going to do the same things your parents did or your mom or dad did or does? Well, here we find Jesus that same way. In Luke 2:49, very early in his life, when he's at Jerusalem, and his parents have basically misplaced him almost, seemed like, he's at the temple, and they find him in the temple teaching. And they say, and he asked, why did you seek me? Did you not know that must be about my Father's business? He's just doing what his Father had been doing. He's appealing to the spiritual side of people, teaching, revealing. And so in that sense there, he is the Father in the activities they're involved in. But also he and his Father were united. As John 10:30, we read about a few minutes ago. And that is, we find in John 17:21, his prayer for all of his disciples said that they all may be one as you, Father, are in me. And I knew that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. Unity. The idea right there, the idea of unity between he and the Father. And explore this a little bit more, we find in John 5th chapter, he goes in that more as far as this unity. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'm about my Father's business, and we're united. And you see that in a lot of things. One, in giving life. Then you just look over here in John 5:21. He says, for the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. We go back to Genesis 1st chapter. Hey, 5:26-27, God said, let's make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let's make them male and female. God created man. And as you look at that, we find that in John 1st chapter, points out that Jesus was involved in creation. In fact, in John 1:14, he said, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld glory, the glory of us only, the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. This Word is involved in creation. Without the Word, nothing was created. John 1:1-3 teaches us. And so Jesus here was involved in creation. And you see that when God made man a spiritual being. not like the cows and dogs and other animals around us. We may love our dogs. We may have favorite pets that we have, even favorite cows. But that animal is not equal to man, and that he was not formed the same way for the same purpose. In Genesis 2 verse 7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils breath of life, and man became a living being. Some translations have living soul. Again, the idea is that man became not just a living animal, but that man is a person, or man possesses a soul, has a soul. And so God created man that way. And what Jesus points out to us in John is that Jesus gives us eternal life. Not just physical life, but eternal life. John 5 verse 24. Most certainly I say to you, he who hears my word, now notice here the conditions placed upon it. And that is, he who hears my words and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment but has passed from death into life. Jesus came, though, not just so we can have physical life, because we already have that. People exist, people is living during the day. Jesus made it obvious. But he came so we can have the spiritual life that he talks about by believing and accepting him and the Father. And so in that one sense, they're united, that they both give us life. But then also it said they're united, and that both and raised the dead. United, raised the dead. I got to think about that. And that is, how many times in the Old Testament you read about people being coming back to life? And there's a number of times here, the widow, Zaphath, I hope I'm saying that right, son. You read that passage there, and here's a time of famine, Elijah the prophet, and he's in the area of Zarephath, and he sees this woman out there as well. She's gathering sticks, and he's talking to her about giving him some water, a little bit of food, and she says, we don't have anything. I'm gathering up this last bit of sticks here, and we're going to go home, me and my son. We're going to eat what food we have left, drink what water we have left, and we're going to die. And he spares her. Her miracle is performed where she won't run out of food. But her son dies later on, and Elijah the prophet comes, and the boy is brought back to life. How'd that happen? Was Elijah doing it? No. It was God. God brought the boy back to life. The same idea, the Shunammite's woman, son in 2 Kings 4th chapter. Again, a case of a child that dies, and the prophet of God is sent for her, and he comes and prays, and then the son comes back to life. Well, how did that happen, God? And finally, the man ran out of Elijah's grave. And there's the case, it was almost like an accident. That Elijah, the prophet, has died. They bury him. And later on, a band comes in, raiding the area. Some people are killed, and they take one of the bodies, and they put it in Elijah's grave, not knowing whose grave it was. And when he touched the bones of that of Elijah, he comes back to life. Now, again, how did that happen? God did that in all three situations. And so we see that power of God to raise the dead. When we look at Jesus in the New Testament, and Jesus says, for as the Father raised the dead and gives life to them, and I believe we could talk about many more situations than just what I gave you out of the Old Testament, but it says, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. Now again, we're talking about different levels of living here, different levels of life. But he wants us to know that they're united, and that as far as raising the dead, giving life. In fact, Jesus, as ministry, one time told his disciples that you're going to see greater works. They got to see a lot of things. They got to see Jesus turn the water into wine, the first miracle recorded for John 2nd chapter. They got to see Jesus heal people, as we just talked about John 5th chapter. They got to see Jesus calm the Sea of Galilee, and just saying, peace be still, and holding out his hand. And can you imagine the thought process of those people when they would see this? His disciples and the crowds. And in essence, what he's saying, as great as those things were, he said, you haven't seen anything yet. You haven't seen anything yet. He said, you're only going to see greater works. Jesus raised the dead. In John 11th chapter, Lazarus. And we look at John 11 chapter, I didn't put all on here, but if you look at John 11 chapter, Jesus had been informed, been told that his friend Lazarus was sick, and he delayed coming to him so that he would die. And when he comes, he has passed away, and Jesus goes to the tomb. And there, look around verse 39, Jesus says, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there's a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said, Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? Then he took away the stone from the place where the dead man was laying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that ye have heard me. And I know that ye always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this, but they may believe that you sent me." Now when he had said these four things, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And when he who had died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth, Jesus said to them, "Loose him, let him go." Now again, just imagine being there and being in this tomb, knowing this man had been dead 4 days, and then simply Jesus says, "Lazarus, come out." And he comes out. In fact, we go on to John 12, verse 1, it said, "Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany," and that's only about 2 miles outside Jerusalem. It said, "Where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead." Going down 12, verse 9, said, "A great man of the Jews knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus." Now again, just think about that occasion. Even the enemies of Christ realized that Lazarus was still alive and he had been dead. We got to do something about this. But Jesus just pointed out that he and his Father won as far as raising the dead. In fact, one last other passage, Jesus spoke of the resurrection. In John 5, verse 28, he says, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming, which all who are in the graves will hear his voice." Now, there are different religious people who believe that only some will be raised, that some will stay in the grave. There's other people who believe that everybody's going to stay in the grave, that there will be no resurrection. But Jesus says that all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. And so he says there's going to be a resurrection when he comes back. He's going to give life. But then the final thing is, Jesus talks about they're united in their judgment. Again, we look at that passage, John 5, 28. "Do not marvel with this, for the hour is coming, which all who are in the graves hear his voice. And come forth those that have done good to the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." And that is that there's going to be a judgment on that day when Christ comes back. And you know, the thing about judgments is that a lot of times that people, we say it about the court system, that people shop for a judge. You hear that phrase. I don't know. I hear that phrase a lot of times on television. You know, they talk about the TV shows, but they're going to go shop for a judge. And what they mean is they're going to find somebody that is more favorable to their side, that tends to rule in their favor. We hear sometimes of courts where an upper court may overturn a ruling of a lower court, which means they decide the judgment by the lower court was wrong. Or you may think about this in a sense of your parents, which is an area I'm sure none of us can ever really relate to. But I've been told that children have a tendency that if they find one parent is the yes parent, they most likely go to that yes parent and stay away from the no parent. And so if they make a mistake, for instance, if we had gone to Dad and said, "Okay, can we do this?" and Dad said no, now the tendency would be, "Okay, let's go to Mom." And hopefully Mom would say yes. Now, usually what happened, though, was Mom would say, "Did you ask your Dad?" And at that point, we say, "Well, what did he say?" "Well, he said no." You know what Mom said? She said, "Your dad said no." I can't recall a single time where she would say, "Forget it. Yeah, you can do it." That would not have been good. However, people sometimes think of God and Jesus, it's kind of like being different judges, that maybe Jesus be more lenient than God in his judgment. And Jesus points out that he and the Father, that their judgments are the same. We can't expect Jesus to make a different judgment than the Father made. In fact, when he talks about his judgment, he said he wants to understand, first of all had judgment been given to him. And when you look over at John 5, again, stay in that one passage. John 5, verse 22, he says, "For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." Now, a lot of times we talk about God making the judgment. But we have to realize, the Bible points out actually that Jesus makes the judgment, but his judgment and the Father's judgment are the same. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, I believe it is, or 17. Look it up for yourself. But anyway, it says, "We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may be recompensed for the deeds done by him, whether good or bad." And so we look here and it says, okay, all judgment has been given to the Son. Not only that, but also he says that he has authority to execute judgment. Again, that's very important because without authority, your judgment doesn't really matter. I can make a judgment on a certain thing, but unless I'm really the one that has authority, it really this last week, if you've been watching any of the basketball games, you know that at most basketball games, there's about 17,000 or 18,000 referees. However, the only ones that really matter are the ones with the shirts on, the striped shirts on the court. They're the ones that have authority. Well, here, Jesus has authority to execute judgment because sometimes people may come to me and say, "Dennis, what do you think about this?" And I may say, "Well, you know, if it had been up to me, it had been okay." But it's not. It's up to Jesus. So he says all and has given him all authority to execute judgment because he is the Son. So we see here that his judgment and the Father's judgment are saints. Jesus has the judgment, power to execute judgment. But also he says to us that Jesus' judgment is just. And what that means is it's right. That we can't say Jesus is making a wrong decision. Again, that's very important. This last week or 2 weeks ago, up in Louisville, I was hearing on news about this guy that had been put in prison about 20 years ago. And they have recently found DNA evidence that exonerated him. They had to release him. And he won a court settlement of $6 million. Now, the reason why he won that is because the courts have made a mistake based on the information they had. But what we know about God, what we know about Jesus is there's not going to be any information not known in them, but also whatever decision is made will be just. And so in John 5 verse 30, it says, "I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous because I do not seek my own, but the will of the Father sent me." Notice how he ties all this back to his Father. And the judgment, the power, and authority, and the justice all goes back to the Father. And what he wants us to understand is that who he is and who God is and how we can please him and how we go to heaven. And that is that he came to die for us so that we can go to heaven. But we have to do what he says. We have to abide by his word. And therefore, they should honor the Son as they were honoring the Father, is what he's telling them. How about us today? Sometimes people want to serve God, but they don't want to accept Jesus. Regina's telling me an interesting statistic just this morning. And that is, I think Dr. Dawson did a survey and said that 90% of men believe in God. 1 out of 6 worship him. That means 16%. What that means is a lot of people think, well, I'll just bypass the whole idea of Jesus and church and God and those kind of things. I'll just serve God and just bypass everything else. And Jesus said, we can't do that. We have to accept him and we don't go to heaven. And the way we do that is what's here on this chart. And that is we must believe Jesus, Son of God. Jesus, John 8, chapter verse 58, said, "Before Abraham was, I am." They were about ready to stone him dead because they realized that "I am" there meant he's deity. Jesus says, unless you accept him, you cannot be saved. But they had to repent of their sins, as Jesus says, Luke 13, verse 3. Have to confess him as Son of God, as God did in Matthew 4, verse 17, when Jesus was baptized. God from heaven said, this is my beloved son, hear ye him. Our confession that this is the son of God, that's the same thing God said. Of being baptized, remission of our sins, Acts 2 verse 38. But then also, to go to heaven, one must live faithfully until death. There's a lot of people who get part of that right, but not all of it. We have to make sure we're doing all of it. So this morning we have this invitation. And I appreciate your kind of attention. If you need to respond to the invitation, why don't you come forward as you stand, please sing.